Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Podcast. I am Ted Kluck, joined as always in studio by my good friend and partner in radio, Barnabas Piper. Pipe, Ronald J. Martin is doing what Ronald J. Martin loves to do the most, which is take pictures of the hotel rooms he's in and probably tweet them out to you, but text them to me. I know Ronald is in a happy place when I'm seeing pictures of his breakfast and his hotel rooms from various places. So kudos to you, Ronald. Way to get on the road. I don't know when he returns, but it will be a sad day when that happens, Pipe. But it's just you and me today. Apparently, Ron's schedule was so full this week, he couldn't spare a moment for his radio program. But
which is a real shame because we can always count on his Wi-Fi to work when he's not in Ohio. But
yeah, his internet is way better when he's traveling.
I feel like we're missing an opportunity right now.
I do too. To have happy Ron and good internet Ron all in the same episode. But Piper, we have to do what radio pros do. We have to soldier on in spite of this, just some hard stuff that we're walking through with Ronald being gone. But one of the things that's not hard about our life, Pipe, is the fact that we have sponsors, and we have sponsors aplenty. We've just wrapped our relationship with Saddleback. So we're waving goodbye to them as they pull out of the facility. And now we have Dwell. Our old friends, Dwell Bible. So, Piper, tell us about Dwell.
Yeah, Dwell Bible app. Longtime listeners will know that this has been they've been a partner of ours for a good while now and will be for the next few months also. It is an audio Bible app for whatever mobile device you use. There's a cost to the annual membership, but they are offering Happy Rant listeners a 33% discount. So if you go to dwellapp.io/happyrant, you can get a 33% discount. So you can do a one-time lifetime membership, or you can pay annually. It's $20 a year, so it's really inexpensive. But the features of the app, some of the ones that I love most are they have a name for it, but I can't remember what it is. But it's basically you can put a segment of scripture on repeat. So if it's a passage you're teaching through, if it's a passage you're trying to memorize or just meditate on, you can put it on repeat with blocks of time between for memorization, for reflecting, for writing, for whatever it is you're doing. It's a great feature. They have all these listening plans to help you get through the Bible in a year or just keep you on progress. They have multiple narrators. They have musical backgrounds if you want something that sort of gives it a little bit more life and energy and different styles in that. And then the other thing that I love about what they're doing is that they're perpetually advancing what they do, adding features, adding technology. So they've added offline listening so you can download it and listen when you don't have a good Wi-Fi signal or when you're driving through the middle of nowhere and you don't have a cell signal, whatever it is, you don't have to use up your data. You can download and listen. So they will continue to roll out those features. But again, go to dwellapp.io/happyrant. Check out the discount. You can explore the app. I think they also have a 7-day free trial if you want to try it and just see what you think before you put your money into it.
There you go, man. Dwell Bible. We are all users of the product. We are all Dwell enthusiasts, and we're happy to have them on board as a sponsor, Pipe. But it pains me to talk about this today because I know this this topic is near and dear to the heart of Ronald J. Martin. If you peel away all the denim, like faux military jackets and shirts, you eventually get to the heart of Ronald J. Martin. And in there is a large section devoted to the Enneagram. Ron loves the Enne. Ron loves talking about the Enne, thinking about the Enne. My question to you, Piper, and this is like to me a really interesting like thing to think about, is what's the future of the Enneagram? Like how long until this bubble pops, and then what's the next thing going to be? So are we a year out? Are we 5 years out? What are you seeing in your like church ministry context? And then I'll relate some stuff from the college space.
Yeah. So thinking about past trends, so in a previous episode, a few months ago, we talked about sort of the previous iterations, you know, there was love languages and Myers-Briggs and StrengthsFinder and what else? I mean, those are the ones that come to mind off the top of my head, but where people can sort of list their thing, whatever their thing is. These are my love languages. I think love languages is probably the most, maybe Myers-Briggs, but love languages especially is the most one-to-one because it's very much about me potentially.
Yeah.
And also very, it has transcended kind of all parts of culture. If you say love language now, nobody looks at you like you're a weirdo or like, you know, it's an 80s album name or something. It just, everybody knows what that is. So I think
it's kind of like vinyl records in that it has survived all the trends, right? Love Languages has survived Myers-Briggs. It's surviving the Innie. That thing is a juggernaut, man. And you're right. It's become like a cultural catchphrase. I don't know. I don't know if there's any killing Love Languages.
Yeah, I don't think there is, because, I mean, it's hard to kill a thing that allows you to say, this is how you should treat me better.
That's true.
You know, if
people are always going to love that.
Yeah, if I'm able to look at you and say, no, I need words of affirmation. Mm-hmm. I expect gifts, whatever it is. It's nobody's going to give up that. Nobody's letting that go away. I do think that most people who use it don't realize it's a book by Gary Chapman, but
that's true.
I think it's just sort of a cultural thing. The Enneagram, I think, it's not quite as transcendent as in terms of transcending all walks of culture, but it's way deeper where it has put down roots. So I think we are closer to a, 5 to 8 year shelf life on this thing than 1 year. I think it'll change shape, but at some point there's going to be like the money is going to back this up. Cause right now there are a decent number of Enneagram related books, but they're still kind of introductory in understanding the Enneagram.
Dude. So who from our tribe writes the first, Enneagram book for like conservative reformed evangelicals, because you know it's going to happen.
Yeah,
it's probably under contract right now, man. To be honest, Ron would love for it to be him, but it's not him that we know of.
But it will be somebody out of like that church planting network sphere where
they're looking for some guy in jeans.
Yeah, they're looking for or Christian counselor, could be either. Although the Christian counseling sphere is not quite as those books don't tend to be quite as popular. So I think it's going to be somebody who's looking at it from like a coaching leadership perspective, that kind of thing. So I think it'll probably come out of that sphere. But yeah, I think once the money catches up, where we now have like the Enneagram and, like five love languages transcended, and then there was like five love languages in the workplace and in for kids and for teens and for whatever. We're going to get something like that with Enneagram for leaders, Enneagram for moms, Enneagram for whatever. And when that happens, that just builds in a 7 to 10 year shelf life. Easy.
Yeah, that's true. Dude, do you feel like there's a soft spot in the Christian counseling market in as much as like back when I was paying attention to it, there was like the Paul and Ted Tripp kind of generation, older guys. I don't know. I feel like there's a real moment. There would be a moment for somebody like Ron, like a conservative hipster, a little bit younger than Paul Tripp. You know what I'm saying? Like, does that person exist? Because I feel like if they did, it would be raining money on them.
Well, that's tough because I feel like counseling has sort of become polarized where there's always been the dispute between, biblical counseling and, do we go to professionals and do medication and all that?
Yeah.
There's a term, nouthetic counseling, that I can never remember what it means, but it fits in here somewhere, and I'm just going to drop it in there so I sound slightly smarter than I am.
That's impressive, dude. You sound really smart, actually.
Yeah,
that's
you
a
go.
Good one.
That's what I was going for. I don't remember what it means, but we'll pretend that I do. So I think more and more counseling is you have pastoral counseling, which is just very gospel-centered, etc., kind of leaning on the sin side of things, sin and redemption. And then you have professional counseling, which is mental health and depression and the kinds of things that people need more ongoing therapeutic treatment or medical treatment or medicinal treatment for. And I don't feel like that was quite the case 10 years ago. I feel like people just sort of, because of there wasn't as much awareness about mental health, for example, people just went to the church for everything. And that's where some of that CCEF, Paul Tripp, Ted Tripp, Ed Welsh, Tim Lane stuff came out of. Like even Paul Tripp has kind of moved away from that. And he's just moved much more into the pastoral and away from what you would call counseling in terms of what he writes.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, I just feel like this is the right moment for like the right sort of pleasant looking 38-year-old guy, which rich 38 would look like normal 30. So he'd look 30, but he'd be 38 to write the kind of like counseling book that was aimed at a younger audience. I feel like people would gobble that up. I just think that that whole thing is really hot right now.
Man, I think counseling's in a weird spot. So having joined staff at a church, I've discovered just the complexity of trying to figure out counseling, partly because there are landmines that, that we didn't used to be aware of. So if somebody's in a position of having been abused or of accusing somebody of that, that's a really complex situation pastorally to handle. Or even things like marital counseling. A lot of times that there are significant pastoral issues, but it's easier, or you know, maybe we're better positioned to outsource it to a counseling center, you know, something like that. And so there's just, it is such a, it, counseling has become an industry. I don't think it used to be an industry. Like there were psychologists.
Sure.
And there were pastors. Now the overlap of the two and churches hiring counseling pastors and things have really muddied the waters. And so I think it'd be really hard to write a book that finds an audience there.
Dude, you're right. It, because the audience is getting so segmented already, like you said. So yeah, maybe there isn't just like one person who's going to crush that one out of the park. But I do think like if the right reformed person wrote an Enneagram book, it would sell like crazy. And it wouldn't be like, who would it have to be? It wouldn't be KDY. He's too pastoral. He's a little too old manish, even though he's not that old.
Yeah.
I don't know who it would be from our tribe, man, but somebody's going to do it, dude. And somebody's going to make a pile of cashish from it.
Yeah. I'm trying to think you don't run across. And we were talking about last episode, how the reformed world is so sort of hypersensitive against topical preaching as opposed to exegetical preaching. Like the Enneagram is sort of the ultimate topical application of principles. And it's,
it's the very definition there. Of topical. Yeah, for sure.
And so it's really hard to imagine. I'm trying to think who in our camp would be willing to go there. I know that there are a bunch of Reformed people who read it, who are into it, and sort of like they do it as a staff or church staff or whatever. Yeah. But I mean,
somebody's got to give Reformed people like permission to love this thing. And whoever does that will be rich from it.
But all of the people who are giving reform folks permission to do anything right now are like 60 plus.
That's true, man. Yeah.
They are Matt Chandler, David Platt, Kevin DeYoung, who it's hard to see them paying a ton of attention to this.
Yeah, you're right. I think Channy has the sort of pop sensibility where he wouldn't do it, but I could see him doing it. Of the three you just mentioned, he has the most sort of like pop sensibility and I could see him pulling it off, but yeah, the other two aren't going to touch it.
I bet Matt Chandler is a closet Enneagram guy. Like, I bet he knows his number.
I bet he loves it.
I haven't listened to any of his sermons in a while, but it's the kind of thing that pastors like him would normally sort of poke at.
Yeah.
But my guess is he doesn't say anything about it because secretly he kind of loves the whole thing.
Dude, I bet he rips on it when he's with, like, his pastor bros that are too good for it. Like if he and KDY are taking a road trip, they're ripping on the Enneagram, but deep down in his heart of hearts, Channy's a fan. What do you think his Enneagram number is?
That's a good question. I mean, I feel like megachurch pastors in the reformed world are, I mean, I would bet he's a three.
Yeah. I was going to say one or three, man. A lot of those guys end up being one.
Yeah. One's threes or eights.
A lot of the pastor guys I know are eights.
There are a fair number of the older guys who I would peg as like fives because they preach and don't like people. I would peg him as a three. That would be my guess.
It seems
reasonable.
Pipe, do you like wish the Enneagram would go away, or are you going to miss it a little bit when it's gone?
I think the Enneagram has probably done all it's going to do for the good at this point. I think it has sort of fully been, usurped by people who just want to talk about themselves, you know?
Totally.
And so it has become the kind of thing that once it enters a conversation, you're like, oh, okay, I guess that's
the end of
that. It's
been a great moment, though. For people who want to talk about themselves, this is a great moment. You know, the Enneagram moment is that was tailor-made. Yeah. And this is coming from someone who, like, speaks into a microphone for an hour each week, largely about himself. So I'm right in the thick of that. But
I find it to be the kind of thing where, like, you know, so at our church, which we've got a lot of, you know, 20 something folks, a lot of single folks. It's just the kind of thing where, like, once that number enters there, it just sort of, it feels a little bit like the, what's the Dr. Seuss book where the creatures have stars on their heads?
I don't know.
But, you know, so there's like, they're the ones with stars and the ones without, and the ones without are lesser. It just sort of feels like that, where you sort of categorize by number, or you're predictive about relationships based on number, or a whole bunch of stuff that you go, none of this has anything to do with real people.
No, that's right. Dude, to my shame, though, I talk about it all the time, like with KK.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we'll be just going about day-to-day life, and, you know, our son Tristan will do something, and we'll be like, classic ape move, you know? And I hate myself for it. Like, in the moment, I know I sound like, you know, such a poncy schoolboy, but I can't help it, man. I can't help myself.
The thing is, it's not that I hate it or don't think it has its place. It's that people are not using it in its place. You know,
I hate being the kind of guy who likes it, but I am that kind of guy at the same time.
I feel like it's like, so for example, you and your wife are, you know, you're having trouble communicating, you're like, whatever. This is the kind of thing that can help understand, oh, this is why Ted's tendency is this and KK's tendency is this.
Yeah.
And then you can respond accordingly. But when it's just sort of the banner under which humanity lives, and it's the it's like a value assessment almost.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
pretty, or it pigeonholes people. Like,
yeah,
I don't,
for sure.
You find out somebody's a two and you're like, oh, they are going to do these kinds of things. They are this kind of person, which is really dehumanizing.
It really is, man. Yeah. We would never tolerate that in any other context. You know, if you made those kind of sweeping generalizations about where a person's from or the color of their skin or whatever, you would be roundly castigated. But we're allowed to do it with the Enneagram, which has been, it's been a lot of fun. Piper, we've talked about your number, right? We've ascertained that you're an eight.
I am, which is maybe part of the reason I hate it, because when people find out you're an eight, they immediately like back up a step and a half. And decide they don't like you in advance.
Yeah, they decide that you're a certain kind of douche, and they write you off. Listen to this, though. All my good guy friends are eights. Like, all of my best friends, you know, almost across the board as guys are eights. I think fours must be drawn to their convictions. But yeah, as a four, like, it makes sense that I can't enjoy the Enneagram, because I just won't allow myself to enjoy anything.
You don't like being labeled and defined.
That's true, man. Along those lines, though, along the lines of labeling and defining and enjoying things. So before I came up to the studio to record this, I was in class and I was chatting with a guy, and we decided that, like, the kinds of guys who fish or, like, tinker in their garages with cars are the happiest kinds of guys. And I'm like, I want to be that kind of guy. Like, you meet those guys, they're never unhappy. They're always like, yeah, I'm taking apart my 67 Mustang and doing blah, blah. And I'm like, these guys are always happy. And I'm almost never happy. So I think I need to start fishing or, like, taking apart cars in my garage, Piper. What do you have to say about that?
I think it depends on how you define happiness. I think often those guys are happy, but that's also because they just don't care about much that happens outside their garage.
Yeah, or I would love to be that kind of guy.
Or their fishing hole. Like, when they are trying to catch, you know, a smallmouth bass or whatever, like, that's all that really exists in their world. And there's some really healthy aspects to that. But I don't know that it's a way to live. I think it's a way to escape.
Yeah, I think so. Which sounds nice, man. And as a four, this... Dude, I want to lay a scenario on you, and then we'll get off the Enneagram, I promise. But this happened to me the other day. I was recording my other podcast, and the host, like, alerted me to this website called Chartable. I'm sure you've seen Chartable. It's where they rank all the podcasts, and you can see, like, how you're doing in Finland and Zimbabwe and all these other places, and it's kind of fun. But The very first thing that comes up in Chartable when you search for your podcast name is reviews. And we've got all kinds of positive reviews, like all kinds of five stars. But the first two reviews just right now that come up when you search Happy Rant Podcast are savagely negative, just vicious. Like, I hate these guys. These guys are the worst. And
man, I haven't looked at our reviews in months.
I hadn't
that
either.
Sounds
like
amazing.
Ever, almost ever. Yeah, Chartable. You can look at them. But I read these two reviews yesterday and I got legitimately bummed out. And I think like an 8 would not get bummed out. I think an 8 would be like, screw those guys, they're wrong. And, you know, you would just feel fine, right?
Pretty much. I mean, I think we've talked about this because we used to periodically read 1-star reviews of our books.
Yeah, which was brutal for me. Just so hard.
And so funny for me. I found that to be just a delightful experience. Because every single one of them I looked at and I was like, oh, well, this is why they're an idiot.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And people have a right to not like my books, but at least dislike them for reasons that include like reading and thinking. And they just didn't. They're like, I expected this to be something different than what it was, so I hate it. Well, that's on you.
Yeah. Whereas the 4, I think, has that experience and goes, wow, maybe they're right. Maybe I'm an idiot. Maybe I'm a fraud. Maybe I should quit.
I failed to deliver what people were looking for.
I failed to deliver what people wanted and what they were looking for. And, you know, maybe I'm just the worst, you know. So 4 should not read reviews. I think that's the takeaway from that conversation. But
I mean, do you find positive reviews equivalently uplifting? Or is the negative is really bad and the positive is not equally as good?
Yeah, I think with a positive review, I'm just relieved that it's not negative. You know what I mean? So it's not like an equivalent level of positive emotion. It's just sort of like relief that I dodged the bullet of a negative one. You know what I'm saying?
Well, you know who you sound like?
Who?
You sound like Tom Brady. Well, I've heard interviews with him where he's, you know, he is relieved after wins and miserable after losses. Like a loss will ruin him until he has a chance to go out and redeem himself. And a win is like, well, yeah, that's what we were supposed to do. Like the best he can feel is sort of a sense of, okay, next job up. There's no like, he's even talking about like after Super Bowls, it's just sort of like he immediately moves on. So he must be like the 4 of the NFL world.
I bet he's a 4-wing 3, man. I really bet he is. But, you know, he's kind of always changing his look, kind of a creative guy. Yeah, I can see that. And he looks like me. So, you know, at the end of the day, like, and our bank accounts are similar. You know, I have tons in common with Tom Brady so much. He's got high-end sponsorships. I have high-end sponsorships. You know, at the end of the day, we're pretty much the same person. But, Piper, I want to talk about, now that we're in the realm of pro sports, I want to keep it here for a minute. I want to talk about this little crackle of controversy that we got from the NBA a week or so ago regarding China.
Well, quick trigger alert for listeners. Yeah. We're not actually talking about basketball. This is much like global cultural stuff than it is basketball. Yeah. It just pertains to a professional sports industry. So,
yeah, 0% basketball content.
Stay with us.
Don't leave. This is not Happy Rant Sports, nor is it Happy Abby, our Downton Abbey spinoff podcast. You can stay with us. But I was interested in this pipe because the NBA has for about – how long has Silver been there? 6 years, 5 years?
Yeah, 6 or 7, I think.
Yeah, so kind of for as long as Silver's been there, the NBA has really hung its persona hat on, you know, free speech and letting the athletes have a platform and kind of being woke, for lack of a better term. Steve Kerr has really, like, leaned hard into wokeness as a persona thing. And I think as a college professor, like, my relationship with wokeness is always one of like, I have to be really woke for my students and really not woke for their parents. And you're just trying to like walk that fine line every day. But,
figure out who you're lying to in any given moment.
Yeah. Exactly. I can't forget who I'm lying to. Exactly. But in the NBA, this is like, by and large, I think, resulted in a lot of positive PR for them, but, it backfired for the NBA in that, Houston Rockets GM Daryl Morey tweeted something about Hong Kong. And then LeBron James tweeted something about maybe Morey shouldn't have tweeted that. And then everybody turned on LeBron James for his lack of, you know, wokeness, at least in that as it pertained to that issue. And I can't hear about any of this, Pipe, without thinking about the era where we just didn't know about the politics of any athlete or entertainer, really. I mean, the two parts of their lives were separate, but now with the advent of social media, it's kind of a thing that they're having to navigate all the time. What do you make of this?
I find it really fascinating because so the way the whole thing started is general manager for Houston Rockets, Daryl Morey, tweets something in support of the protests in Hong Kong. And he, you know, he doesn't make a long diatribe. It's just he used a slogan that they use and essentially expressed a level of support. Well, yeah. The Houston Rockets have huge business interests in China. They, one of their former star players, Yao Ming, was from China, and so they have shoe contracts, and they're one of the favorite NBA teams there. And just the NBA is one of the most global professional American leagues. And so, like, the Chinese government basically held the NBA's feet to the fire and was like, "This he should be fired because that's not acceptable." Adam Silver says he supports Morey's right to free speech. And the Chinese government, well, which realizing it's not a total monolith, but it kind of is. A representative from them responds and says, "We don't believe free speech applies to matters of the state and of politics and criticism of government." Which is to say they don't believe in free speech because that's the whole point of our amendment, as the First Amendment, is that people can speak out against government freely without, you know, risk of,
right,
of being charged with a crime. And so it's just the implications of it are huge. And then you get athletes who are mainly just like, "I'm a brand. I'm trying to sell some shoes."
Exactly.
And win some championships and whatever. They get sucked into this. So LeBron is basically like, "Yeah, I kind of wish they'd leave it alone because I'm trying to make some money here." And then exactly. he gets destroyed by the protesting side because that's exactly the opposite kind of stance that was taken with somebody like Colin Kaepernick, where the right. money is not the issue, the rights of the people are the issue. And so it's essentially sucked people who are completely unprepared for this kind of debate into it. And now everybody's just no commenting right and left. And which is ultimately probably the best solution because, I mean, for the NBA, it's the best solution. I don't know.
Sure.
And for fans, it's probably the best solution. It might not be the best support of protesters in Hong Kong and around China, but I don't know what the NBA is like. I don't know what the NBA's role in that is.
Dude, right. I mean, if you're the NBA, you're trying to like spread your influence into these countries, and the NBA has been really aggressive in that part of the world in a way that, you know, like the NFL just hasn't made that part of the world a priority as much. But yeah, it gets dicey when there are like major political differences. But if the only thing you have in common is basketball, but we live in the kind of world where people on both sides are making statements all over the place all the time and you can't really control it, then, it makes it hard to be in a business relationship. Right. And I mean, the best thing the very, very best thing that happened to the NBA was games starting two nights ago. Because I do think this one will die a natural death in the news cycle, but it gave interesting insight into how politics have become. And when I say politics, I don't even mean like Trump versus whoever, but just personal politics have become such a plank in the like persona building platform, you know, even for somebody like Steve Kerr, who, you know, a decade ago, Steve Kerr was just the white guy jacking up threes on the Bulls when I was growing up. And then, you know, 5 years ago, he became the architect of this, you know, multiple championship winning dynasty. And now he's sort of like woke tweeting architect of the dynasty. And it's weird. You know, it's not good or bad. It's just it's a strange like context to have to think of coaches and players in. And it's kind of, for now, the unique purview of the NBA, I think.
When it's weird because even thinking of Steve Kerr as like the woke whatever, which I mean, the number of times we've used the word woke just makes me a little bit nauseous.
Dude, talk about that. Why?
I hate that word so much. It just
Yeah, I mean, I hate it too.
Why do you hate it? There was a window of time where it meant something, because there was very much a shift, especially in issues of like race relations, where people went from "I've never thought about this" to "I'm now thinking about this." Like, it was an awakening.
Sure, sure.
Now it is a mostly self-proclaimed statement as almost like a status thing, where it's like I'm one of the good white people, essentially, or whatever. And so somebody like Steve Kerr, it's frustrating to me. Because his dad was a foreign diplomat who I think was murdered overseas. He was, I think he was an ambassador maybe. And so like his history of international relations, of race relations, of being globally aware is dramatically different than, I don't know, Stephen A. Smith and his upbringing, or Charles Barkley and his upbringing, or Daryl Morey and his upbringing. Like, there's so he and Greg Popovich are the two most outspoken NBA coaches on this stuff. Well, Popovich went to I think he went to West Point and has served overseas and different. I mean, there's just there are different levels of awareness, thoughtfulness, intellect. And yet, because they work for the NBA, there's just a blanket perception of you are an entertainer, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Which is mildly aggravating to me. But also, yeah, it's frustrating to me that we look so heavily to the words of somebody whose primary responsibility is drawing up X's and O's for professional athletes.
So that a guy
can
throw a ball through a hoop.
Yeah.
I mean, really, what... Yeah, who cares what Steve Kerr thinks about any of this stuff? And I say that in the nicest way possible, right? Like, why would I get worked up about that necessarily? But I think what's tricky about it, though, is that if you are any kind of a public figure, I mean, including like you're a pastor or you're a college professor or you have a podcast or whatever, like I think. Sometimes I feel like the expectation is people want to know like where I'm at on that spectrum. And I actually feel in my heart of hearts, okay about where I'm at on that spectrum, but it's not a persona plank.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a thing that I lead with. And I don't know that it ever will be, but I feel like sometimes like because of when we're alive, there's the expectation that you have to like fully, you know, make it a persona thing, you know?
Yeah, it's the persona aspect of it is it happens by accident if you're in public. Mm-hmm. If you make any statement that is heard publicly, it is now a persona thing, even if you were just trying to even sort through your own thoughts. Or, as in this NBA situation, are caught totally off guard by a situation that's outside your area of expertise.
Yeah.
But you now have a persona as siding with one side or the other, that kind of thing. And so, yeah, you just sort of like LeBron is now wearing a label. Now he'll shed the label. People will forget quickly because we have an immediate news cycle. But he's wearing a label of taking a side, and Steve Kerr is wearing a label, and Adam Silver's wearing a label, all based on trying to navigate something that none of them have any business navigating.
That's true. And you know what? The more and more, I think, I mean, Nick Nurse isn't wearing a label. You know what I mean? Like, I think probably not talking about a thing that you don't have any business talking about is probably the best way to go. I don't know. Maybe that's
cowardice talking. In the moment, you'll be criticized. In the moment, people will be like, oh, you should take a stance on this. Why aren't you saying anything? But big picture, it is best to say, I'm not prepared to answer a question on that.
Dude, it's funny, though. So, like, why do we expect, and I got to keep this quick because I know I got to go and so do you, but why do we expect certain people to take a stance and certain people not to? For example, like Bill Belichick, most successful NFL coach in the history of the game, you know, has been on top of his industry for 20 years. Like zero times have we ever asked Belichick to like expound on some political thing or take a chance on it or you know, back some candidate or whatever. Like he's just the last guy that we would expect that from. And I wonder why we have certain expectations for him that we don't have for, you know, NBA coaches or
I think it is the stance that the NBA has taken where the NBA to their credit has invested in societal issues. I don't know that they've always done it well, but they have more aggressively and progressively tried to be aware of the racial issues in the country and in the league. So you remember back to the dress code that was instituted maybe early 2000s?
Yeah, I totally remember that.
It was basically the anti-Allen Iverson dress code, because Iverson was like blinging, big chains, baggy clothes, what the league thought.
Jerseys.
Like, and it was the Jailblazers era, so everybody was like, oh, these guys are all thugs, which is just coded language for, you know, racism. And so they put in basically a business casual dress code.
Yeah.
Well, shifts over time, and they haven't swung the envelope back the other way, but now they sort of are like, let's feature our guys as fashion icons.
Totally.
Let's
so brilliant.
Yeah.
So brilliant.
And getting in on LGBTQ support. And of course, our listeners are largely not going to be in favor of that, but societally, it's a progressive move. Or would be viewed that way. And so because they've done that, though, they are now attached to issues, not just basketball. The NFL only exists for football and money.
Yeah.
Basketball exists as a platform for personas, personalities, voices, declarations, etc.
For better or for worse.
Yeah.
You know, and like you said, that always doesn't always break in the right direction. But it is fascinating to think about. Piper, it has been fun to wander to and fro throughout these issues with you. And I need to let our audience know that we will talk about John MacArthur and Beth Moore. I've gotten emails about this. I'm sure you've gotten hit up on social media about it, Pipe. We will talk about that. We've been given strict orders by the producer of our program, Ronald J. Martin, to not talk about that until he can be back and be a part of it.
Because Ronnie is nothing if not full of very pointed opinions on this podcast.
I was going to say, at which point he will dance around the issue and not take a side. But I guess he wants the opportunity to do that in person on the radio. And who are we to deny him of that, Piper? You know,
it's not our place.
Yeah, he needs to travel and then come back and be noncommittal about John MacArthur. So we will look forward to that next week. Piper, we've wandered to and fro throughout these topics. Check out the Dwell Bible app. And until next time.
The Happy Rant is brought to you by Resonate Recordings. If you go to resonaterecordings.com, you can see the full range of services they offer. So if you're considering starting a podcast, they are the ones we recommend going with. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see their prices, to connect with them and ask any questions, and to see what they can do to help you launch, edit, master, and improve your podcast. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see what they can do to help you launch and improve your podcast.
Hello, this is Dr. Doug Grotheis, host of Truth Tribe, where we seek the truth through reason and evidence about what matters most. And we are not tribal, since truth is for everyone. Please join me at the Truth Tribe as I discuss the reasons for Christian faith, the Christian worldview, and moral issues such as abortion and gender ideology. To listen now, go to lifeaudio.com or search Truth Tribe on your favorite podcast app.